Well, we'll be taking your test on the program on 026-441-8767. 026-441-8767 into our first story. Former First Lady Nana Akufo-Addo Ajiman Rawlings today made some startling comments about living in Ghana, saying currently Ghana is one of the most expensive places in Africa to live. The former First Lady was interacting with women from about 25 countries on the continent on the Mileage Fellowship International Program in Accra. The program seeks to empower women on the continent for leadership positions in their countries. The former First Lady's comments come against a backdrop of falling inflation figures and a generally improved economy. We want to look at Nana Akufo-Addo's comments of the policy think tank Imani, headed by Franklin Kujo, who is now on the line with us. Good evening, and we are welcome to Behind the News.
Good evening, sir, and good evening to your listeners.
On face value, how do you see Nana Akufo-Addo's comments?
Well, on face value, I'll say that just as every individual has the right to express himself or herself, that is their personal opinion. I would want to move on and say that observation, by the way, is not a new thing. I mean, you and I probably have been saying that, hey, times are probably hard now, or things may get better. Indeed, so she's not the first to have those sentiments. So on face value, I'll say it's a non-issue, really. I mean, it's not an issue. It's possibly because she's coming out from a campaign, she's been badly bruised, and so depending on how she said it, probably the body language with which she said it, or the emphasis with which she said it, has almost made it like a topical news. But I mean, you and I go about and say, oh, Salinyamamwaya Dinyo, it's the same thing she said. So I don't think it's an issue to be really splitting our heads about.
Yeah, but Franklin, people are raising concerns, and you've already just touched on it, that coming from a campaign where she was badly bruised. But at a forum where you have people coming from elsewhere, was that an issue, really, that should be discussed?
Well, sometimes you can't control how these discussions go. I mean, in the heat of the moment, you sometimes get carried away to make certain statements. I'm not too sure, even envisaged that the statement would probably generate this much attention and response. And so, without sounding as if I'm patronizing her, I think that where she chose to make the statement, again, is a non-issue. The most important thing is that we should be looking at the issue and ask ourselves, is this something new? Is it the fact that some foreigners do not also know that probably things are difficult in this country, or in any case, when they want to do business across the continent, they may want to compare the levels of taxation, for instance, interest rates, and what have you. People do all these decisions anyway, so it does not necessarily mean that because certain African leaders have come to her and she's making the point, I'm sure they themselves who heard it would say, well, but do you know what this is in our country? You know, so I don't think even the places that were, the place this was said, again, is an issue. By the way, there's a global phenomenon occurring right now. Times are hard everywhere. Just that I think what we should be asking ourselves is, why is it that we in Ghana, despite the fact that everywhere else is difficult, why are we not getting certain things right that we should be getting right? I think that's where the debate should be. And I'm like, I would like to stay on that course and say that, yes, depending on the way you manage your economy, you tend to project a certain lifestyle for everybody. So if, for instance, interest rates are high, if, for instance, corporate and income taxes are high, it tends to eat away from whatever disposable income you have. And by the way, this is not something necessarily with the current administration. It was with the previous administration as well. And indeed, it's a general thing. We keep saying times are hard. And I think the most important and crucial factors that we should be looking out for are what are those things that make us the way we are and we should that we can stand out from the rest. I think we have a significant opportunity to stand out from the rest of the of Africa, indeed for many, many countries in Africa. I think we can get certain things right.
Yeah. You mentioned we can get certain things right, and presently we are talking about inflationary figures dropping to single digits and other things, but you have mentioned consistently that, oh, people will even say in the local language things are not so easy. But contrasting it with what happens elsewhere, people will also be saying, oh, perhaps Ghana is better. Can we say that if she says things are difficult, necessarily it means a bad economy?
It doesn't necessarily mean a very bad economy. I wouldn't also say that the economy is so, so good. I think everybody seems to be pretending to do it well. But let me just take you back a bit on the issue of inflation. I think it is not the politicians' fault sometimes to be latching on to these inflationary figures. I think that the people who compute these figures are the ones we should be blaming. Because clearly speaking, if you look at the basket of goods that are used to collect what you call the consumer price index, which determines inflation, they are so small. We are talking about 242 goods. But clearly speaking, in modern times, most countries are collecting 3-4 times that size. And you can't live in a country where the fiscal service will tell you that, well, you spend just 0.3% of your annual or your monthly money on communication. You and I know you spend a lot more. You don't spend just 1.6% of your disposable income on education. In this day and age where we have extra classes and people seeking professional qualifications, it's become more. So when we don't take into consideration these significant factors, and you come out and say you have a single-digit inflation, well, the politician will latch onto it and say, hey, this is my scorecard. I'm doing well. But the rest of us know that those are just paper verifications of what ordinarily is not the case. So inflation anyhow, whether small or big, is bad for an economy. I think the most crucial thing we should be asking ourselves is what can we do right in a country that we have by giving opportunities to entrepreneurs. And I think government should also not so much get involved in the business of creating employment. Sometimes we hear government wants to create this, create that, and then at the end of the day, it becomes part of the problem. Because they do not, you see, governments, and not this government, by the way, governments generally, and I stand by this statement, generally across the board, all over the world, are wired in such a way that they don't seek perfection, you see. Because the fact of the matter is that because they are wired in the way not to seek proper ways of doing things, that is why when they create jobs, those jobs are not long-lasting. You find out that when they rather push the private sector through tax incentives, through lowering crime rates and all these other factors, you tend to see that the private sector in all countries that are doing relatively better hold the economy, not the other way around. So when these things come up, I think we should be able to look at them passionately. Let's remove ourselves, our emotions from the statements that have been made by Nana Kodadu, and then look at the issue dispassionately. I used to argue at one point that 50 pesos can only buy you a bowl of kenke and hot pepper in Ghana. But there are certain parts of this world, and I've traveled widely, there are certain parts of this world, for instance, a place in India, you can get a very nutritious meal for that figure, you understand? That is a bit well balanced. But the question someone will ask you in return is, oh, but do you know the purchasing power parity if you combine the, if you compare the two countries? And I say, That is exactly where the answer lies. Because whereas $1 can do much more in India, it can do the same in Ghana. And why? Because of the cost of running individual as well as corporate level activities in the country. That's the difference.
Yeah. Frankly, we seem to be losing you, but I guess you've raised a lot of concerns in relation to this, and we want to thank you very much for your time this evening on Behind the News. Franklin Kujo is in charge of the policy think tank Imani, and he joined us on the line. And to our next story, still following up on the floods in Ebuakwa. President Jonathan Mills yesterday paid a day's visit to the flood-ravaged areas in Fantiakwa, Etiwa and Kwaibibrim in the eastern region to find out the extent of damage. The government has therefore instituted some measures and provided relief services to mitigate the plight of the victims of the floods. Some observers, including the Ochieng or Sajifwa Mweti of Oripenin, had attributed the extensive damage of the floods to illegal mining. But critics say illegal mining, or galamsey, is not a recent phenomenon. It has been with the country for long. Governments over the years have paid lip service to dealing with the problem. At least that is what people think. The government is only interested in large-scale mining, so they say. With the recent floods in the Ebuakwa in the eastern region, what lessons will the government be taking from it? Mr. Mike Hammer is the Minister for Lands and Forestry, and he's also on the line with us. Thank you so much for your time, sir, this evening.
Thank you. Thank you, too. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Would you agree with those who say that over the period, governments have paid lip service to tackling the issue of galamsey?
No, I wouldn't say so, because we were back during the PNDC era. We were confronted with the same problem, and the PNDC came up with the PNDC law. I think 2023, I'm not too sure, but just about 2 to 3 of in 1989. And the idea was to legalize the galamsey operations and bring them into a formal sector and give them license to operate on small scale mining level. So the problem has been with this for some time, but then previous administrations have all made efforts to ensure that we bring the activities to reduce the activities of the activities and the impact to the environment.
Yesterday, the Eastern Regional Minister raised a concern that perhaps would be reverberating even as you try to solve that problem, that issue of politics, when you try to tackle some of these issues. Do you see that's a big challenge in looking at the issue now?
No, you mean what did he raise?
Yes, when he was asking that anytime you have to talk about this, sometimes it is pushed into the corners of party politics.
Well, really, I do not exactly understand what he means by that. But what I do know is the fact that, yes, illegal galamsey operations has been with us for some time, and the understanding is that some big people have been behind it. I have, since I assumed the responsibility of that ministry, I haven't had any cause to believe that some big man had actually intervened on behalf of any galamsey person who has been caught or found to be doing something untoward. I haven't really had that experience, but he probably had some reasons for that. Yes, that's the situation, especially when he's very close to the people, being the regional minister in a very, I would say, a prime location where mining activities take place, like the Eastern region.
Yeah. So, presently, what are you going to do with the present situation?
I think that it has to be a multi-pronged approach. Short, immediate, and then medium and long-term approach. The short and immediate term is important for us to understand that it is legal and must be stopped. If we do not do that, we run the risk of degrading the environment. And as long as we have people who would flout the rules and regulations, the laws must be enforced. So we think that the Natural Resources Subcommittee Task Force organizational security would have to be empowered and well resourced to carry out the operations of flashing out this legal legal manners or the galamsey on a sustainable basis. The challenge has been with their ability to sustain the operations. They started and it's like it started over a period of time and unable to sustain it because of financial challenges. I believe that it's about time that we find money to resource them so that on a continuous basis they can carry out these operations so that we will raise the risk of doing galamsey operations and then with the hope that the activities will be reduced. But we also, it's also important for us to also ensure that their migration into the legal structure of planting the activities in the right legal infrastructure by going through the process of getting the small-scale license must also be made easier. And education and sensitization of the communities, because it involves the chief, the traditional authorities, the social assembly, and other stakeholders. It's multi-sectorial interagency collaboration, and all the major stakeholders will have to be sensitized for them to understand the issues. So I believe that, yes, the short-term immediate, stop them, because it's illegal, we can't have that. And then the medium and long-term, you have to look at them, a multi-pronged approach. First of all, let's look at the rules and laws that exist now. I can tell you that some of them are so regressive, so deficient, so outdated that they are not in tune with the modern trend in the mining industry. You understand? Because laws are not cast in stone. They are not sacrosanct. Laws are supposed to help you to achieve a certain set of objectives. And when those objectives or goals are not being met, it means that you probably would have to review those laws and see how you can ensure that you amend them for you to achieve your goals and objectives. I'm saying so because we have situations where some galamsey operators have been arrested, and when they are taken to the law courts, they are given very, I would say, light sentences, which were not deterrent enough. But my own experience have shown that the judge is restricted in a way, in the sense that the judge will only rule based on the evidence available and then the law prevailing at a particular point in time. So from the charge sheet to evidence gathering to the engagement of the judge to understand and appreciate the enormity of the problem is a challenge. You have most of the prosecution being done by the police. Can you imagine a police prosecutor going to a court to prosecute an illegal galamsey operator who has been arrested? And he has so many dockets with them. The legal team, the legal galamsey would just be one docket. And he doesn't really understand the issues because he's not trained, he's not specialized in it. So he's not able to engage the judge in a constructive way. For example, this galamsey operator might be using dangerous chemicals like mercury, and then in a river that has the potential of compromising the health of quite a number of people and a population downstream, you understand? Somebody who understands the issue would tell the judge, look, judge, the activity of this man can pose a health hazard to population downstream who use this river as a source of drinking water. You understand? Immediately the judge begins to appreciate the enormity of the problem. You understand? So I'm saying that, and the judge, that some of the laws as it stands are also regressive and deficient. You must bring them up to the modern trends so that the judges as the rule on these issues, the laws will not also be regressive and tend to affect them. So I think the multi-pronged approach is also to do with the institutional capacity building, training the people in various institutions for them to be able to implement the policies.
So have we started immediately to do something?
Yes. If you can recall, I just met the Chief Justice a couple of weeks ago, and the idea was to engage her constructively for us to look at some of the difficulties that confront us. And we organized a workshop for the judges. The idea is to throw more light on the existing legislations, the gaps that exist in the legislations. And then let me tell you one example. In one of the situations under the existing wildlife The Existing Wildlife Act is called the Wild Animal Preservation Act 43 of 1961. And the regulations that we have currently are the Wildlife Reserve Regulation 1971 685 and the Wildlife Conservation Regulation 1971 710. Look at them, 40 years ago. So if a judge, if an issue is brought to a judge, and the judge is confronted with such law which is so regressive, what do you expect the judge to do? So in such a situation, and in some instances, it came to the fore that some of the criminal procedure codes are also deficient. Because what they call it, some laws that give discretionary power to the, like the Criminal Procedure Code of 1960 Act 30, Section 143, gives the power of discretionary power to the judges. Sometimes when they have confiscated this illegal, the equipment of this illegal miners, the judges return them to them.
Okay.
And then the reasons why they do that is that they use the CPC and the Criminal Procedure Code that gives them the power of discretion. So
yeah.
I think that in all this, we should try and level out.
Okay.
So we can reduce the discretionary power. Where there's a discretionary power, it must serve the end of justice.
Okay.
So we will have to look at it from all fronts.
Mr. Maikama,
once we all get involved, understand and appreciate the issue, and collaborate at all levels, and I believe that we'll be able to bring the problem or reduce the problems that can
to the barest
minimum.
We want to thank you very much for your time this evening, Mr. Mike Hammer, as the Minister for Lands and Forestry, on the issue of Galamsey protests and what is being done. But Mr. Daniel Cranton has been working as Executive Director of WACAM, an organization that has been concerned about mining communities for some time now. Thank you very much for your time on the program today, sir.
Yeah, thank you too for having me on this.
Yes. How do we deal with illegal mining? This time we are looking at the Bwakwa.
Yes. Hello?
Hello, Mr. Cranston. Yes, we are asking. You have been working directly on the ground, raising concerns and all. With the present situation, how do we really deal with it? Because the minister is saying that there's the need for a multi-pronged approach and support and all.
Yeah, I tend to agree with the situation, what the minister said. But let me first and foremost say that the situation did not occur overnight. It has been going on for some time. At least we are aware that Ochehini has been leading a whole campaign. Some of us have also had calls to add our voices to what Ochehini has been doing. Everybody is aware that we're heading towards a disaster. BRIM is being diverted at various levels, at Ankasi, Esikem, Pinaman, Abomusu, Michia Bompe and Osino, all over the place. And we, as a country, as usual, we always trail behind problems. We always we don't move ahead of problems. We don't take early warning serious, and then we get caught up in the situation, and then all of a sudden we'll be talking and lamenting, and after some time, when the whole issue dies down, that's the end. For me, that is the worry, and we may have to go through the whole cycle of problems again and again and again. This is the time to act. This is the time to put measures in place. This is the time to have environmental laws that will make it a crime for anybody to destroy any water body. And I think I heard the minister talking about, you know, the justice system and how weak it had been. We don't have strong environmental laws in this country based on which we can take action. So if, for example, we have realized that the Galamsey that used to be a pickaxe and shovel Galamsey had turned into some kind of large-scale mining, if we go to Atumbuakwa, the people involved in the Galamsey are not using pickaxes and shovels. They are engaging large-scale mining. illegally. And that brings up a new challenge. There are Koreans, there are Chinese, and even Israelis, you know, companies have been formed. People are operating as if they are legal companies. And even some of the companies, illegal companies, are even engaging in corporate social responsibility. They are building schools, and the schools are being commissioned here and there. So the new trend is you know, brings to fore new challenges, and we need strong actions and strong laws based on which we can protect the water bodies. If we are not prepared to do that, if we don't have the political will to do that, then I don't think that we'll get anywhere. We'll continue to lament.
You've raised one big issue, and from the minister's statement, the political will is there. But I posed that question referring to what came up yesterday in the course of the tour, that sometimes, even if the media should report on it, people start talking about the fact that, oh, after electing a government into office, that government is trying to deprive its own people from even earning something. How can it be effectively done so that you get all on board, not looking at it as somebody's interest being worked against, but a concerted effort in the interest of all residents?
If you are somebody who is familiar with what goes on in the mining sector, the dynamics have been said that before people can do this, there should be a network of politically connected people, of security agencies, of some local chiefs, of some powerful people who support such a thing. That is the experience we have had in all the places that we go to. Because, mind you, it's about money. It's about, you know, making people rich. It's about doing, you know, destroying dream and making money out of it. So when you are able to make money and you are prepared to, you are able to protect your interests, you end up even trying to even connect to politics. That is what you know, people do all the time. So sometimes, even when the state or the government wants to act, the government will have to have a strong political will to say that I'm going to do this, in order to protect the environment and the water bodies. That's right, all the consequences. And I think that the political will, we have not demonstrated political will enough. Not this present government. It's all governments. We haven't seen this kind of political will coming strongly. And if you look at even the manifestos of all the political parties, they have not demonstrated that these are issues that are big problems that they have access to. And that is the starting point. If you don't have the political parties actually demonstrating that they are going to address these critical problems, then as far as the social contract that they have with the state goes, they haven't told Ghanaians that they are going to address this emerging problem in the small scale sector, which has turned into a large scale kind of illegal operation, sort of. So, for me, if you ask me, I'll say that the political will, we haven't demonstrated enough political will to address the problems. If we go on further into the issue of conflict, I have studied how these illegal operations have fueled conflicts in countries like Sierra Leone and Liberia and Congo and whatnot. So I get a bit worried that a lot of people are going to have a lot of money from the illegal operations. And once that becomes the trend, you have money concentrated in the hands of some of the illegal operators, and then they become warlords in future.
Okay,
and that for me
is a big problem. Mr. Osukranting,
because the fact that the people have been able to operate peacefully with impunity, diverting rivers, shows that they have been able to overcome our capacity to regulate them, our capacity to stop them.
Yeah. Other issues are coming up, and for now we want to end it here, but still we'll be exploring things around what WACAM has been working on for some time and how we can continue to sustain the tempo in getting this illegal operation out of our system. We want to thank you very much this evening for at least joining the discussion. Daniel Usu-Cranton is the Executive Director of WACAM. Behind the news on Radio Ghana, and to our next story. The establishment of orphanages as a way of catering for needy ones has come under the searchlight for some time, with the care reform initiative of the Department of Social Welfare. Some orphanages have been closed down and the children relocated. Under the initiative, the establishment of homes is being discouraged for various reasons. In spite of this, a number of orphanages still exist and are receiving donations from philanthropic organizations. The question is, why are the orphanages still existing since the care reform initiative has been in place for some time? Is the department still approving the establishment? There are more issues to explore here, and that is why Behind the News now digs deeper. Helen Obiasamwa is in charge of the care reform initiative, and we're glad she's joined us on the line. You are welcome to the show, madam.
Thank you.
Yeah. Will you say that since the care reform initiative came into being, you've succeeded in stopping the mushrooming of orphanages?
Yes, we will say yes. We have succeeded in, preventing a lot of other orphanages from springing up. For instance, people do come to us to talk to us about opening new orphanages, and we have discouraged quite a number of them. And apart from that, the rate at which children were being admitted into homes has also, been minimized because of this initiative.
Yeah. We talk about the care reform initiative. Can you tell us in a gist why it is so much concern about closing down and not licensing orphanages?
Let me explain that what the initiative is about is to make sure that children will not go into homes as a first resort. Like, as soon as we find out that a child has a problem, it's not an orphanage that should be the answer. The real issue should be explored, and then we look at what options are available. Like, do we have other family members who can take care of the child? Can the mother, with some kind of assistance, continue to take care of the child? Can any other family member do it? Can we get a foster parent to do it? And if there's nobody, then can we have an adoptive parent take care of that child? So the initiative aims at making sure that when children need care, the appropriate care is given. And then when they have to go into institutions, which should always be the last resort, the institutions should be the best. They should have all the resources and all they should run according to standards. That is what it's all about.
Yeah. So from what you are saying, it is not just a matter of quickly moving in to close down an institution. Where you don't find certain things existing, then it means you must act.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is happening is that, when the initiative started, a lot of children were found in homes. Let me say that quite a number of them have been reunited with their families. But you see, there are some children who have lived in homes for a very long time. And you cannot just go there and say, well, we close you down, so go back home. We are working on with families whose whose family members, like children, have been in institutions for a very long time. And then we're also working with the children as well. Right now, we are even in the central region trying to work things out so children can go back to their homes safely. Homes they have left several years back, and many of them don't even have any connections with their home anymore. So when we go into a home, it's not about, the whole initiative is not about closing down homes. Of course, if we have to close down, we do it. And it depends on what type of children you have, and then whether the children need to be there or whether they have to live in their family. And some of them opt to close down after the training we did, and when we go there and we talk to them, and they realize that the children can be in the community and they can rather offer support to the children in the community.
Yeah.
Some of them have offered to close down.
Okay, so about how many have you had closing down since you started?
We have on record 14, but just as at last week, one also opted to close down in the eastern region, another one. And there are some that has to be closed down because there are abuses, but you know, these are being investigated.
Okay. Madam, just hold on for a while. We want to go quickly to the Village of Hope. Esuman Kakare is with that institution and perhaps one of the institutions that is doing its work according to some of the dictates of the profession. You are welcome to the show, Esuman Kakare.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. In your case, how do you get inmates for the Village of Hope?
Basically, we are to go through the social welfare for what we call social background investigation. And in some cases, the social welfare that undertake those investigations and at the end of the day gives a recommendation and forward the cases to us to adopt those children. And in some cases, we also go out of our own way to do investigations and find out whether such children actually qualify to be in our orphanage.
Okay.
In such a situation, we send social workers to the background of every application that we receive.
Okay. So,
Hello.
Yes. In the effort,
when we receive such applications, we send social workers to go to the background or to the family of such a child.
Okay.
And then after thorough investigations have been done, we submit the report to the board of directors of the orphanage, and they take a decision as to whether such a child qualifies to be in the home. There, the basis for determination is need, and by need we mean a child whose parents are no more, or in a case where the parent is alive but is incapacitated and in the situation he cannot take care of the child, and then there is nobody also in the family background who is capable or willing to take care of such a child, then they will determine whether such a child to be in the orphanage.
Okay. We want to thank you back. We'll later be getting back to you on a few other things in relation to it. But coming to you, Mrs. Obina Samwa, from what we've heard, it means that you assist some of the organizations in their activities. Is that it?
I wouldn't say assist. If you look at the Children's Act, it's it's social welfare that has the mandate to determine whether a child should go into an institution or not. And so I am a bit worried with the second part where he said they send social welfare to go there and then the board rather decides whether the child should be admitted or not. Usually if the social worker determines whether the child needs to be in an institution or
okay.
not, and then if the home has the facility, if they have the facilities to take on that child, then after 7 days, the social worker goes ahead and takes a care order. So
okay.
I don't know. I've not been there, honestly. So I don't know what...
Madam Obia Samwa,
yeah.
These are issues we'll still be looking into. But for now, I want to thank you so much because of the time.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Madam Helen Obia Samwa is with the Department of Social Welfare Care Reform Initiative. And before we go, some of your tests here. This one is coming from Azizotu from Gomwai Kropon number 1. He says, even though we sincerely sympathize and empathize with our fellow compatriots in the eastern region, we would also like to appeal to those engaged in illegal mining to desist from the act. And Aziz Dola, Nana Kunedu should help the government to deliver. Let us all join hands in solving our problems and not blame, not be engaged in a blame game. Oh, Ghana, motherland, Allah save us. Aisin Obwasi, Nana Kunedu is not saying anything new. Ghana has been expensive since the days of PNDC. President Mills is doing his best. Kojo Akins from Cape Coast, Nana Kunedu must be told that currently Ghanaians are better off than from 1981 to 2000. And Dan from Boku, we should look for long-term solutions rather than putting pressure on leaders to do magic within 4 years. Lukman Gushu, Nana Kunedu is calling a spade since are really very hard. And Mali from Bripe, there is no point blaming Galamsey operators over the floods in the eastern region. It is quite unfortunate that government will have to spend millions of Ghana cedis every year to support flood victims, yet we are failed as a country to take some pragmatic measures over the years to address the situation. NADMU must be serious, for Ghana cannot continue to spend huge sums of money on flood disasters. And this is where we wrap it all up for today. On behalf of our team of Edmund Tete, Christopher Sidu, and Bright Agama, my name is Kinsley of Interest. Behind the News.